One of the big themes at the Mining Indaba this year continues to be ESG, environmental social governance, and mining's role, obviously, in the so-called just transition. Now, we've had Paris, we've had Glasgow last year, and this year, COP assembles in Egypt, which I think will only heighten the focus on climate and the E in ESG through the remainder of the year. Now, the thing about mining is it's previously been seen as this extractive industry with a serious negative environmental footprint, but we've got mining leaders, tier one miners like Anglo-American, embracing the change that we're seeing in the world, both in their operations, as evidenced by the unveiling of a hydrogen-powered mine quarry truck last week, and also the fact that the transition to renewable sources of energy and decarbonizing the world's energy system is going to require millions of tons of newly mined minerals, things like cobalt and lithium and copper and the like. So mining and miners are going to be around for a long time. So there are challenges, obviously, but there are also opportunities. To talk about this, I'm joined by Dr. Martin Porter. He's a senior advisor in FTI's public affairs practice, and he's in Cape Town, usually based in Brussels. Martin, great to have you on the show. You've been deeply involved in the ESG conversation for some time now. In addition to your FTI role, you're also the executive chair of the Cambridge Institute for Sustainability Leadership in Brussels. So it's not a conversation that's unfamiliar to you. How are you hearing this conversation play out amongst the mining firms that are present here at the Mining Indaba?
Thank you, Michael. Yeah, it's great to be here. And actually, the theme of ESG and sustainability more broadly, I think for the first time, is across all of the issues which are being discussed at the Mining Indaba. So rather than being a subplot and an item left towards the end of the conference, as has been in the case in the past, this time it's threaded throughout, and therefore it's a really omnipresent issue in many ways. So everything you said about the context and mining's role, its opportunities, but also challenges in that context, are really top of the agenda for people here, I think. I think you're absolutely right. The transition to a climate neutral economy and society is forcing, obviously, not just a move away from fossil fuels, but for creating a new energy system in particular. And the role that mining of the metals that you mentioned is going to play in that is crucial. So demand is clearly going up for those metals. And the opportunity for Africa in that context is huge. So miners of those metals are well aware of this. At the same time, they're very well aware of the fact that, exactly as you said, they have other challenges, amongst which the fact that they also produce emissions and CO2 emissions from their activities. And therefore, whilst there is a huge opportunity here, they're very well aware that they have to be part of that reduction in emissions in their own activities. And historically, they have focused on so-called scope 1 and scope 2 emissions, which are the ones that they most directly control in their own operations.
Yeah.
And the attention is going to shift more and more to what are described as scope 3 emissions, which are ones that the supply chain, the value chain in which they work, also creates emissions. And that's more of a challenge for them because those are less directly in their control. But if we're going to reach these climate neutrality targets, of course, they're going to have to address those. And the investors who are present at the Indaba, are looking towards exactly those companies that you mentioned to show that they're able not just to serve the needs of the energy transition, but also demonstrate they're also part of the solution to their own emissions and their supply chain emissions coming down. So they can do both, but they both require profound investments and changes to some extent in their business models, which there are many different ways to approach. But there's lots of ideas I hear today.
Is there clearly there's an awareness of this ratcheting up of pressure. Is there a sense and a feeling that these mining companies are equipped to deal with these various interests, sometimes competing and conflicting interests and demands that are being placed on them?
I think they are equipped, but they have to be wary of accusations of greenwashing. There are obviously good initiatives. You mentioned one with respect to Anglo-American. And that's just one of many examples which you know, I'm hearing about this week. At the same time, they are under enormous scrutiny, not just in Africa, but around the world, for whether or not the commitments and the strategies that they are putting in place are genuinely aligning to the Paris Agreement objectives of well below 2 degrees or 1.5 degrees. And there, it's not quite so clear that they are putting in place exactly what they need to achieve those targets. And that scrutiny is going to increase. There are NGOs who are very focused on this. There are academics, think tanks, international organizations who are going to hold them to account on this. And I think that at the moment, those strategies are just starting to come under more serious scrutiny, and it's only going to increase. But they're coming under scrutiny from investors as much as NGOs. And I think that's the big change. Finance, the financial community is much more aware of the challenges and the need to tackle these issues, and they're going to put the industry under scrutiny too.
As we see with BlackRock's Larry Fink and the like, you know, stewards of trillions of dollars worth of pension fund capital and the like, placing the spotlight firmly on ESG issues for several years now. It's a real challenge though, Martin, because on the one hand, and there's an example here of a group of European oil majors selling off their drilling rights in an oil field in Nigeria to a local private equity-backed company over there. And it was a win for them because they could get a lot of those assets off their books, and it demonstrates a commitment to reach net zero by mid-century. The problem, though, is the emissions from those wells didn't vanish. Instead, they then just increased dramatically, actually, under the management of this private equity firm that isn't answerable to shareholders or the public in the public domain, certainly is answerable to its own investors. But there is this balancing act. And if you look at what Glencore is doing, for example, and the coal side, Glencore has said, well, what we're going to do is we're going to keep the assets and we're going to manage them down responsibly, whatever that means, rather than offloading them to a smaller party that potentially might not do the right thing with these assets. So it's not cut and dry, to your earlier point on greenwashing.
No, not at all. I totally agree. The divestment strategy does not always make sense. And as you say, a responsible investor will be one that looks at a pathway over the medium and long term, as well as any short-term actions it needs to take to align to these long-term targets. Divestment doesn't necessarily achieve those responsibilities because it passes them on. I think there is going to be more regulatory pressure around non-listed companies as well. So the financial sector as a whole is going to come under more scrutiny over time. Rules and regulations that we see currently applying to listed companies are gradually going to be extended to other players as well. We see that happening through proposals in the EU, and I think it is likely to spread beyond that. Capital obviously is extremely mobile, so once you start to set a set of rules in place, and they are taken up certainly in more than one jurisdiction internationally, particularly where they are major financial centers, then that will have an effect over time. But you're absolutely right. In the short term, it's a fine balancing act. And there is obviously a risk that we will have potential short-term misalignment and increases in emissions even as we move to an overall system transformation that is lower and climate neutral in practice. And we see actually just the effect, since it's so much obviously on the top of many people's minds in Europe in particular, the Ukraine situation.
Yeah.
Clearly there's a short-term energy need to replace essentially gas and indeed oil, which would have been supplied by Russia, by Ukraine, or directly. But at the same time, I think if you look at the underlying strategy that the EU is doubling down on, it's increasing its target and its investment in renewables, grid infrastructure, and let's say housing, and all of the energy efficiency improvements that need to reduce energy consumption. So whilst it is obviously going to replace fossil fuel in the short term, the underlying strategy is to still change the system and to change it more rapidly. And it might be that in the process, there is a short-term spike in emissions, notwithstanding that longer-term goal. And I think the same balancing act, the same dilemma is going to play out, obviously, in Africa as well as other locations. It's not going to be a smooth, linear path to net zero. It will be bumpy, disruptive, and there will be a lot of arguments along the way, of course.
We're already seeing that take place here in South Africa. Obviously, our power crisis is well known and documented. Eskom probably the single biggest risk to the South African economy right now, and ensuring that we solve its debt problem, ensuring that we transition away from coal, but at the same time do so in a way that is mindful of the resources that we do have at our disposal. And yesterday, the president asked for the world to give South Africa space to extract oil and gas as we transition to a clean energy system. And on the one side, it may upset those who just focus on the E. On the other side, if you're focusing on the S, the social implications and impacts of this, one could probably argue quite cogently that South Africa needs energy more than anything else if we to bring down poverty rates, create meaningful economic participation, employment, and improve the lives of so many South Africans. Again, complex scenarios. But given where South Africa has placed itself in this conversation at Glasgow last year, I think we walked away with one of the marquee deals at the Glasgow COP summit, in that $8.5 billion of just transition funding, which is supplied by a broad coalition of our Western partners, seems to be a model for what might be rolled out in the rest of the global South. That is, for a long time, it's been locked in this argument with the developed world around what role it has to play in terms of the costs that now have to be borne, because the developed world has obviously benefited from over a century's worth of development on fossil fuels. And now the developing world is saying, well, you know, we haven't had that same benefit, so you've got to pay up. How do you see that debate playing out globally?
There is going to be an investment cost to renewal of energy infrastructure. To some extent, whether it's in South Africa or elsewhere, there's quite a lot of aging energy infrastructure that needs new investment anyway. And therefore, the question is not just about cost, it's actually how to mobilize and deploy the right level of investment. And increasingly, it will be a marginal decision that will be in favor, actually, of renewable energies and smart grid infrastructure, rather than centralized fossil fuel power generation, which has been the case in the past. But I think that your underlying point, that the takeaway from Glasgow that you mentioned, that partnership, that type of investment, is exactly what I think South Africa and to be honest, other African countries will be well advised to push for much more of at the next COP and beyond. I think the developed world, Europe, the US, and others are well aware of the let's say the historical advantages that they've had, but the common need that they have to share in the investment requirements in the next 20 to 30 years, and immediately now, for other economies also to participate. And I think there is there's almost a leapfrogging opportunity in some areas here for lesser developed economies to be able to go more quickly to some of these much more efficient, climate neutral solutions without having to move away effectively from many assets and infrastructures which are to a great extent locked in to those types of high emissions outcomes. So it comes down in many cases to money, exactly as you said. And I think the case for that money to be mobilized towards South African investments is one that will require partnership, and the discussions, I'm sure, at the next COP will center on those issues. And I think that there's a regional case here as much as a national case. And if there's something that seems to be coming out of the Indaba as well, I would say it's also that there seems to be a much greater sort of sense of common perspective amongst African countries as a whole to these questions, where, of course, the, let's say, the leverage, the negotiation power and influence that they will have at the COP, and indeed, you know, after that, is greater the more that they act in concert. So I think that that's only to be encouraged. I think that's the right thing to do. And I think that, you know, the wealthier countries will see the mutual advantage in them doing more of these issues, more of those types of partnerships. And I'm sure it won't be the last one we will see. But there's obviously negotiations necessary, and they have to be put into practice as well. So the commitments and the promises, if you want, need to be turned into real money on the ground, projects, you know, coming to life. And that, I think, is still taking a bit of time, even after Glasgow. So we need to see this happening on the ground as well.
Yeah, real exciting opportunities, though, if you just look at the green hydrogen space. And what South Africa and Southern Africa, if you look at our neighbours in Namibia and Botswana as well, we're endowed with great natural assets in terms of solar and wind, and we can transform those, you know, into green hydrogen that could be exported to Europe, which has got a huge demand for green hydrogen. We can help Europe decarbonize its steel without having to beneficiate here and take European jobs away. And it becomes a win-win discussion. But it is about, you know, having those discussions and building them out into COP27 at the end of the year. Martin Porter, thank you very much. Great pleasure sharing your insights into the very dynamic world of ESG here on Hot Business. Take care.
Thank you. My pleasure.